This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert S. Stark. I'm joined here with Logo Daedalus. Logo, it's great talking to you.
Nice to talk to you, man.
So, you have a book out. It's called Selfie Suicide. It's a fiction, and it's a fiction novel about a failed artist, and he goes on a date to a parody of an art museum.
That's a pretty good summary, yeah. I would give something about that myself if I were to summarize it for someone.
Is that your only novel?
Yeah, it's my first novel, like full-length thing. I've written a bunch of other stuff, but this is the first thing I've decided to publish.
And what are some of the themes that inspire that?
I was mostly, it kind of all struck me, kind of like the ending scene and a couple of the scenes within the book itself kind of just came to me a few years back. And it kind of went outward from there, like trying to see how these visions sort of connected and what sort of themes I could mine with them. It's about a lot of things, but I think it's mostly about it's like a Kunstlerroman is like the German word for a Bildungsroman, which is like the coming of age story, but it's a particular like coming of age of like an artist story, and it's of a bad model of an artist because it's supposed to be like funny. It's like a satire. So the character is kind of based off of some people I know in real life, the protagonist anyway, and some like people I've met online.
How would you describe the main character, his personality profile?
He's kind of just like a huge fuck up loser incel. He's like a model of a failure. Just a kind of failure in general at almost everything. Has like bad notions or bad understandings of what art is for and what it should do.
Is the museum sequence, is it surreal or is it an outright parody in the book?
There's elements, like the surreal elements kind of come in and out. It's mostly based off of some like art museums I've been to. Particularly, there's like a new style of art museum these days, which are like kind of like Instagram art museums is what I would call them, where they're places that people basically go to take pictures of themselves in various situations or whatever. They're kind of like those like cardboard roadside cutout things, except expanded into a much larger building. I thought those were pretty interesting. And actually, as I finished the book, New York City put up this atrocious monument, which is just a bunch of stairways all on top of each other.
Oh, yeah, but I think I've seen photos of that.
Yeah, yeah, basically it just exists for people to, like, one, take pictures of, and two, take pictures of themselves, like, in or at in various places, and that sort of interests me. Like, I think it ties in well to some of the themes in my book, considering the title is Selfie Suicide. I was imagining, like, I should have written it so that someone jumps off the top of one of those, you know?
Have you lived in New York City?
Yeah, I lived in New York City for about 6 years. I moved out of there last year, and I've been living in Texas since, and I have no plans on returning.
Are there any political themes in the novel?
Probably. There's, like, not really particularly. I guess you could probably find political themes in it. I don't know. Politics wasn't really what I was thinking of. I was thinking more of, like, technology.
What role does technology play?
In the book, it's that's one of the major questions. Is like the antagonist is more of like a tech utopian in a certain sense. Like he represents more the what I sort of envision as the future of the current technological landscape we have right now is kind of what the museum is also representing to a certain degree. I was trying to keep like try to find a way to contain strange contemporary forms, things like speed runs and like Twitch streamers and stuff like that, and how this could possibly play out in the future.
Do you have any literary influences?
Oh, tons. I mean, probably everything I've read has influenced me to a certain degree, but in this book particularly, the things that I was thinking of was Nabokov's The Defense, Vytold Gombrowicz's like Cosmos and Pornographia, Nicholson Baker's The Mezzanine, and I'm sure there's others. Lots of Gogol. I was trying to write a kind of Gogolian story, kind of like the Overcoat or his St. Petersburg tales, kind of like a gothic horror of the metropolis.
Besides your novel, what are you primarily known for?
Probably just like shitposting on Twitter. I don't know. I guess that's how I have an audience at all. But I consider that to be sort of a like aphoristic form.
Are you part of any particular scene on Twitter?
Yeah, I was a part of like Frog Twitter for a while. It's kind of like not as strong of a group as it was a few years ago. It was kind of like a Wu-Tang Clan type of association type of thing, you know, like a bunch of accounts were kind of tied together, but a lot of the bigger accounts or some of the main accounts kind of disappeared or kind of like went inactive on that sort of thing. These days I'm mostly just involved with the Autistic Mercury, which is a magazine that's a chief is a Compot. So me and Compot are probably the most close association you could make with me right now.
You write articles for Autistic Mercury?
Yeah, I wrote some on its old incarnation. I'm working on some right now for its current incarnation. I've written for Jacobite, some other of those types of magazines in the internet sphere.
Did you also write something for Terror House?
Oh, I gave them a poem of mine to publish, I believe. I haven't really published that much stuff. I'm kind of trying to like hold on to it right now to compile so I can make a book, so I can make some money off of them, you know?
How would you describe your political views?
I don't really know. I guess I'm like, at my heart, I'm always been an anarchist to a certain degree. Like, I don't particularly like authority in general. But as I've gotten older, I've sort of realized the role authority plays is kind of inexorable, that it like has to exist to a certain degree. In that sense, I guess I'm more of like a Republican in the classic sense, in that if I was put in like a feudal circumstance, I think I would support the Republican cause just because I prefer the interests of artisans and like labor, I suppose, over financiers.
Were you ever affiliated with the dissident right or the neo-reaction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I read a bunch of that stuff. Reading Moldbug was very formative for me when I was a teenager, and just because it was a perspective I'd never encountered in my life, or I don't think hardly anyone would really encounter it, except if it hadn't been for Moldbug making it more popular amongst, I guess, a certain set of like libertarians. But I was kind of involved in anarchist circles far more earlier than that, and there's a kind of weird overlap there between them and like the anarcho-capitalists and the libertarians, who are kind of in a certain sense on the fringe right, in that you would find people talking about Bitcoin in say 2010 or 11 or 2012 who were like anarcho-communists or like Rothbard, Mises, libertarian types.
So are there any specific political issues that interest you?
I don't really know about like specific ones. I kind of like I've been less interested. I'm not like as interested in like policy or like any particular things like that. It's more like I'm more interested in the technological frameworks underneath it all. I think that politics is pretty much determined by the technological landscape for the most part. Like as we see with the Trump election, like I can't imagine that of happening outside of the technological milieu we have right now. If he didn't have a Twitter account, if a bunch of other things didn't exist, I don't know if it would have been possible.
You mentioned in one of your other interviews that you're interested in Wyndham Lewis. Blast basically was like a precursor to zines. Is it more his artwork or his political ideas?
I just love Wyndham Lewis. I think I've done a lot to popularize Wyndham Lewis on the internet as of late, just because I stumbled into his work by being interested in the modernists of the same time, you know, like reading a lot of James Joyce and stuff like that, T.S. Eliot, all of the modernists, you know. And he was involved in that scene, but no one really talked about him, so I started reading a bunch of his stuff, and I think that he's, like, very underrated, and he's also just, like, a great writer. Like, he's hilarious. He's one of the funniest writers I've ever read, and his political views are, like, I find, like, you know, they evolve over time in his life as he was reacting to things around him, so there's kind of a strange sense that some people are, like, pushing him as, like, a fascist of some sort, which is something that he would call himself kind of ironically in the same sort of way that other people might call themselves, like, Stalinists and things like that. So it's hard to really determine whether or not he was, like, I don't know, like, if he's, like, on the American New Right. I don't think that he was really, like, an ethno-nationalist or anything like that. If anything, his major influence politically is Proudhon, who was a French anarchist, like the guy who invented the term anarchism. And other than that, he was, at the end of his life, he pretty much saw that the American cosmic dream was the most powerful thing on the planet at the time. But yeah, I guess the punk zine thing is like an interesting tie in there. He definitely, like modernist art in general, was definitely a forerunner of the punk scene. And, like rock and roll music, zine culture, sort of self-publishing, stuff like that. The modernists, you know, didn't have that much access to the bigger publishers. They often publish their stuff in very small editions. Like if you were to get one of the original copies of The Egoist, which was a tiny magazine run by this anarchist girl who was obsessed with Max Stirner, I also really love Max Stirner. She was the one publishing a lot of the modernists in the early period to, like, probably 1,000 people were subscribed to this magazine.
Have you read his book, The Art of Being Ruled? It basically makes the case that the artists are the best to rule. And that basically that capitalism and liberal democracy suppress genuine cultural elites.
Yeah, I love The Art of Being Ruled. I probably recommend that. I recommend that book like almost every day, or send people a link to a free copy of it, considering it's pretty difficult or expensive to track down in physical form, and it doesn't really exist on most of the internet. It's hard to find. It used to be freely available on some libraries. I forget which library it was. You could read it online for free, but someone downloaded that and re-uploaded it on like a private site.
Oh yeah, there's a couple for sale. There's some for sale on Amazon, but they're going for $100.
Yep, it's really unfortunate. I don't have a physical copy myself. I hopefully one day I'll bite the bullet and shill out $100 for it. It'd be worth it though. It's one of the most prescient books I know of. Especially, but if you get it, you should get the newer edition. I'm trying to remember the name of the publisher, because it has some elements, some pieces that weren't in the original edition but were found amongst Wyndham Lewis's papers when they were republishing it.
How would you describe the ideas put forth in that book?
I think I would just call it like the satirical view of the world. It's a perspective. He would call it like his Vorticist perspective. A sort of view of the world as inherently absurd, the acts of humans as being overdetermined by their influences, a lot of people being kind of followers of specific creative types generally, like a certain idea, like he talks about Nietzsche being watered down so that there's like now a whole class of people, of Nietzschean people, which is kind of a strange thing to think of if you think of Nietzsche as being about like kind of individual greatness and whatnot, that if this becomes democratized, it's kind of ironic.
And you're a supporter of Andrew Yang. Do you want to talk about what about Yang appeals to you and his economic stances, including the basic income?
Yeah, I mean, I think Yang is like the interesting, because I think we'll have more candidates that are doing things like UBI and whatnot in the future. I don't know if he has much of a chance. I think he kind of pussied out, to be frank, earlier in his campaign when he was getting a lot of attention. And now he's kind of like, he's kind of just like floated back to appealing to like, I don't know, nerds a bit mostly, when he could have just, you know, come out and been the president who's going to give you free money, which is, I think, like a great, great gimmick. You can't beat that.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what happened is the mainstream left was bashing him for his support, having support from the alt-right. And I wouldn't say he has embraced the identity politics of the left, but he has tailored his message somewhat to as a reaction to those personal attacks based on his support.
Well, he has the same sort of problem in that he talks about the sort of electorate that won Trump the election, which is, as he's often talked about, the Midwestern factory workers who had all their jobs sucked off by offshoring and, technological improvements in automation. So these are the people that he was talking to, but he doesn't really have any sort of respect for their identities in a strange sense, in that he's was pushing like anti-Second Amendment ideas, the idea of like, you know, gun registries and all these sorts of things, which you'll have like, you know, it's impossible to have like a wide reach really if you're going to alienate people who are Second Amendment types, because that's a huge part of the American identity in general. He's like, you know, from the cities. So this, the urban rural divide, I think, is one of his major weaknesses.
Yeah, he has addressed that issue, but it's a lot of it does have to do with just his personal background and where he grew up.
Yeah, I think that's probably the major problem. I don't know. I don't think he has much of a chance to win, possibly, though. I'm interested into seeing like what the response will be from the debates, because I don't think most people have heard of him, but a lot more people will be watching the debate, and I just think the idea of like the $1,000 a month is very viral. I think once people imagine it, enough people start imagining it and talking to other people about it, I think it could have some legs to it, but we'll see.
It could really start up local economies, because so much of the wealth in the nation is concentrated in a few, among like a select group of people, so it would, a lot of areas that are economically disenfranchised, it would pump in so much revenue into those areas. But the other thing is, it could start a cultural renaissance.
That's
because
like
culture, because culture needs, it does need some kind of funding, and a lot of people who say are artists or writers or musicians, they have to put their art aside to work a low-wage job.
Yeah, I mean, I do it myself. I work a part-time job. I've had a full-time job before. I don't think $1,000 a month would be enough for me to, like, quit what I'm doing currently or do nothing. I think that, I think it would probably – it's also just, like, good for more than just local economies, but just for the fact that Americans in general are in so much debt that this would kind of relieve some of it.
Yeah, it's not enough to live off of. It's more of a cushion.
Yeah, I really don't think it's like, you know, I think it's more just a reflection of like how much poorer living standards are now than they were in the past, at least when it comes to like comparative living standards. So, you know, you used to be able to make a living wage at a lot of different types of jobs without having to work an extreme amount of hours, but things have kind of slid back from then. So anything that gives people more money, I think, is good.
And if, say, Yang probably won't get the nomination, and if it's just like a generic Democrat, they might institute a UBI, but they might do something totally different, like either tie it to some kind of racial reparations program, or institute it based more on like a Chinese-style social credit, even.
Yeah, that's my fear, is like why I would particularly want his version of it to be pushed through, because it's a universal and it doesn't have those sorts of restrictions. And it would be like, it's like the simplest form possible, but it's also the form that people in power probably wouldn't want to have. They'd much prefer it if you could, you know, use it as a weapon of some sort. So, like, you know, making sure that, like, I don't know, like felons or something don't get $1,000 a month. I don't know. They'll come up with things. They always do.
Yeah, because Yang was making the case that if felons get a basic income, then it would decrease the reoffending rates, because you get a lot of people that are totally unemployable because of their criminal records. They're more likely to turn to crime, so it would reduce both crime rates and incarceration rates.
And recidivism also. Well, just like, as you said, like the idea that if you have nothing to lose and your only income is from crime, then, you know, you go to jail and it's like you lose your income from crime. But if you have a UBI or whatever, it would probably disincentivize as much criminal behavior, but it would also make it so it'd be something you wouldn't want to lose by going to jail. So.
And you can also make a case that giving it to middle-class people, as opposed to just giving money to the poor, then it's not just about giving money to the needy, but if you give people extra, then that's money that people can use to help out other people.
That's true. It's also, there's like a certain strangeness in America where if you're like particularly poor and you're already on like welfare programs and these sorts of things, there's really not much for you to like lose when you have these programs. Like you're there, you have like a sort of stable income, and like say you were like, there's a certain point where like they're in so much debt or like are worth so little that there's little that can be lost at that point, whereas like people who are in like the lower middle classes, etc., who are like attempting to pay off their debts as opposed to just like accept it, like sitting on them forever, like just like not like, you know, like they're people who have to tread water as opposed to like floating. So I think that, you know, that whole segment of society, the middle class down to like the lower middle class, would probably benefit the most. And the fact that people don't consider that as like a class worthy of patronizing or, you know, supporting, that, I mean, that's where I come from. Like, I just think of like what $1,000 a month would do to people that I know in real life, like people I grew up with, the area I grew up in, which was especially hit hard by the recession and other things like that.
Was this somewhere in the Rust Belt?
Moving offshore. I would consider part of the Rust Belt if you consider parts of like upstate New York part of the Rust Belt, but I think Western Massachusetts, if anything, kind of collapsed before the Rust Belt collapses, because we used to have a lot of manufacturing. Like that's like where the Industrial Revolution was really born in America, and all of it's gone. It's just all gone. You see, like literally, like we've had abandoned factories everywhere. Some of them reappropriated for other means. Some of them just sitting empty and with, like, you know, trees growing through them and whatnot, and some of them were destroyed, but there's really not much there, not much going on, and there's a lot of kind of lower middle class type poverty where there's just not much to do. There's like more people, and they all end up leaving.
Were a lot of people that you grew up with, do you know a lot of people who fit that demographic of the Obama to Trump voters?
Absolutely. 100%. I feel like that's I know a lot of people like that. I don't think, like, the fact that some people find that to be strange, I think is just telling of how little they understand people, because I think that that's a totally logical voting order that a lot of people actually did.
Because there's a map of where the Obama to Trump voters are located, and it's pretty much all in the Rust Belt or other parts of the upper Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, the district I grew up in is generally one of the like more Republican districts in Massachusetts, but Republicans in Massachusetts are very different from like Republicans elsewhere. They're more like, they're closer to like what I would call New Hampshire libertarians.
As far as your economic views go, to what degree do you support state intervention, and what degree do you support, are you more support capitalism?
I support more state intervention, I suppose, just because I think that there already is a lot of state intervention. And I think that the state, like, what the state's job is only to intervene in the economy, what by, you know, extracting money and sending it elsewhere for either projects or, you know, redistributive schemes of some sort. Like, that's the only job that the state really has, is to tax and spend. So I think that a stronger state with it really just comes down to like who's running the mechanisms, in my opinion. Like, you know, we just need better stewardship than that's the real question, much less than what the system itself looks like.
Are you more of a futurist or a traditionalist?
I don't know. I don't really see a difference between them. I don't think you can really be a futurist without being a traditionalist, because if you don't know like the tradition, then you can't possibly like imagine something that comes afterwards that's new, as opposed to how would you know that it didn't already exist at some point, or that like we haven't already gone through that or something. So I don't know. I just get, but at the same time, I think that like all traditionalism is about, you know, maintaining the current tradition, the tradition, and making it new, and making sure it goes on. So, you know, it's you got to prepare, save the tradition for the future. So it's like the future of traditionalism.
Or kind of the concept of retrofuturism, like we're going like one direction is we're going, maybe we're going in the wrong direction, and then reactionaries just want to go back to the past. So retrofuturism is kind of the idea of what could have been if we went and like you reach a fork in the road and you accidentally go in the wrong road and trying to go back and then try to get to like what could have been instead of the direction we're heading in now.
Yeah, retrofuturism is interesting. I think that it is mostly like tied to specific aesthetic fetishes for the most part. Like, I don't know, people who are particularly into like steampunk or any of those sorts of things probably are just like, I don't know, have an attraction to Victorian aesthetics. And people placing that in, say, like the people who are really cyberpunk now, kind of like the 80s, 90s vision of the future, and are still trying to maintain that. And then there's like the diesel punk or like the in-between zone, which is a sort of like Fallout aesthetic of like the 1950s. And I think that a lot more of the what we'd call like, I don't know, the reactionary right or whatever, are kind of like the diesel punk futurist types. I often wonder,
is diesel punk the same as deco punk?
Yeah, it's like art deco. It's just like the diesel economy. It's like you know, it's like Fallout 3 or whatever, or like Ayn Rand books.
Oh yeah, or also the Bruce Timm, who did Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, I remember I did this. That's why we're talking, is because I did this thread on Bruce Timm's vision of Gotham in both the animated series and in Batman Beyond. And what he really understood was that the cyberpunk and the like art deco punk or diesel punk, like 20th century styles, were pretty much the same. There's like only a slight difference in changing the way that certain characters look, or like the lighting especially. You see a change from red lighting, kind of like warm lighting, to a more cold neon.
Do you think artistic productions become more streamlined? And you said that in comic books is the one area where you see illustrations that are more ornate.
I mean, in underground comics.
Yeah, underground comics.
Like independent comics, yeah, for sure. Because they're like labors of love for the most part, so people still put effort into them because they're not huge industries where they have to make sure that, you know, their sales are growing or above certain figures and whatnot, and they don't cut corners because they're making, you know, what they love. They're making something that they put a lot, that they have their own like invested value in.
Do aesthetics play a role in your writings, including your novel?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of like my book is kind of an exploration of various aesthetic philosophies that I think exist contemporarily, and they're kind of showing it's attempting to show like the problems with some of them, or like the conclusions they lead to. Yeah, I don't know. Aesthetics is everything, man. Aesthetics isn't everything.
So you were talking about that exhibit in New York where it's this giant stairwell. That's not really retro. You wouldn't say that's particularly retrofuturistic. That's more futurism based on current trends.
Yeah, but at the same time, you could sort of imagine like a modernist architect in like 1920 making something like that. Like, you know, you could imagine like someone like Salvador Dali making a kind of a Assyrian stairwell to nowhere.
Yeah, maybe if it was done, it'd be interesting if it was done back then, it would have had a totally different aesthetic.
Yeah, probably. I just think that, you know, we're kind of still dealing with the fallout of the modernist movement in art, and that was ultimately just like a reaction to extreme industrial technology changing the art market and just pretty much everything.
Have you been inside any of those hotels, especially the ones designed by the architect John C. Portman, that have these really massive atriums? The one, I forget the name, I think it's a Marriott, maybe it's a Hyatt in Times Square, New York.
I think so, yeah. I think I actually went in there to use the Wi-Fi one time. What about them?
Yeah, that's like a really great example of retrofuturism. Most of them were mostly from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, New York City itself, like where it has nice architecture, was being built up during the big boom of Art Deco. So if you're in like Midtown and you see a lot of the buildings like that, like around, or like, you know, Grand Central Station around there, you'll find a lot of those sorts of buildings, or up by like Rockefeller Plaza. And I always liked that aesthetic. I like 1940s, 50s New York style. I think it's very nice. Yeah, but, you know, we don't, it's now if you make it, you're quoting like a time period, you know, it's not really a contemporary anymore. It's ornamental from a time period in the past, but at the time it was radical.
Yeah, one of the biggest tragedies about the Great Depression is if the economic boom of the 20s continued, imagine all the great like Art Deco skyscrapers and architectures that we've had. I'm sure you've seen those illustrations. Well, there's a number of different ones. There's the film Metropolis, there's the Italian futurist illustrations, and just of what these futuristic cities, what they predicted they would look like based from the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, it's certainly something to imagine is how things could have gone elsewise. But yeah, I don't know. It's like a lot of people have a lot of problems with modernist architecture, as they say. But I don't think all of it's bad. You know, there's particular schools. I think they can look good in certain contexts also. Like, you know, sometimes a brutalist building in a nice landscape is actually nicer than trying to, like, you know, enforce some huge garish, I don't know, townhouse.
I know there's these radical traditionalists on Twitter who are constantly posting these memes where they just have this totally irrational hatred of any kind of modern architecture.
Yeah, I think that they're, you know, they're ultimately dreaming of the world before the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, their ideal world is one in which, you know, none of these technologies exist. There's no cars, there's no highways, there's no telephone poles and lines, there's no cables, there's no transformers. All of these sorts of things wouldn't exist, and they consider them a blight. Like, you know, we've been talking forever about that picture of Breezewood, Pennsylvania, with the bus stop with the gas station signs and people.
Oh,
bemoaning.
Yeah, that's the one that's really going around.
Yeah, it's been going around for a long time. I understand people's like problems with it or qualms with it, but it's really not made to be aesthetic. And there are other rest stops that are made to be aesthetic in some sort, but a lot of the time they end up looking like, you know, the same way that a French fry shop in Disney World is themed in a certain way. So it's like more aesthetic. I don't really know if the Disney Worldification of everything it would improve it, but maybe, I don't know. Disney's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it would, but that's not really futuristic. That's just a kind of like the
that's a retrofuturism in general. Like,
no, oh, I'm not talking about Disney. I'm talking about that truck stop that all the traditionalists on Twitter are posting that meme. That doesn't really represent like futurism. That's just more the kind of mundane, what's considered kind of generic. But I do really like the mid-century road sign architecture.
Yeah, you mean like the Route 66 stuff, like old timey stuff. It's funny how a lot of that is like, you know, you'll have like, I see people buy those they sell those as like merchandise, the like old Coca-Cola signs and things like that from the 20th century, like all of these things that were just like advertisements or things people like as art now. So I don't know.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting how the role aesthetics play in politics, because if let's just say we don't talk about politics, you sort of to try to guess someone's political ideology based on what aesthetic imagery they like.
Yeah, you can pretty much, I believe ultimately that like politics is based in an aesthetic vision of the world. So people imagine the world as they'd like to see it, or a world that they'd like to see created, and they tend to, you know, retrofit their ideology as a sort of attempt to create this world or instantiate it in some way. So that's why you have, you know, the reactionary trad caths looking at cathedrals and then at gas stations, and they go, oh my God, we need to do something so that we build more cathedrals and less gas stations, because, you know, they don't like seeing those things.
I would say pretty much every group, maybe less so with mainstream conservatives, care less about aesthetics. But
oh no, I disagree. They have a very specific aesthetic that they care about quite a bit. It's just a lot closer to those gas stations than other people.
Maybe a generic, like, just a large home in the suburbs, maybe.
Yeah, they kind of like, you know, kind of classic Americana 50s, you know, America, the suburbs, and, you know, kids with short haircuts and playing baseball. I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be kind of
like,
interesting.
It's really not much more than that.
If politics worked that way, let's just say we put aside, like, all political ideas, and every debate would just be, instead of debating political ideas, it would just be a competition who could create the most dynamic aesthetic vision.
I think that's what it is. Like, I think that is really what it is you have at least esoterically or subliminally, when you hear politicians talk about their policies and, you know, what it will do, they try to create something for you to imagine and hold on to. And then, you know, you're involved in that vision. And then you feel like you have to do something so you can help it come about.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Do you want to talk about any upcoming projects or long-term plans you have?
Not much. Buy my book, I guess. I've just been working on some stuff, working on Autistic Mercury, working on a collection of my old tweets with some essays. Stuff like that. Probably have a poetry collection coming out at some point, and have another novel in very early stages. So yeah, got a lot of stuff coming up. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just keeping it rolling, man.
Logo, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me, man.